Welcome to Walden Pod. I'm your host, Emerson Green. So I had a few scattered thoughts about physicalism that I wanted to share with you. So I come across many what I would call internet materialists. I don't love the term because I don't think there's anything inherently bad about being on the internet. It'd be pretty hypocritical of me to say otherwise. But I don't really know what else to call this type of physicalist who is supremely confident that physicalism is true and has terrible reasons. It's like you're not doing justice to this idea that I don't even like. And there are physicalists who I respect, you know, who are philosophically adept and very intelligent, and I respect them, even though I don't have that much respect for the position that they defend. David Papinow or Michael Tai, formerly. But I see these other people come in and they act like it's so simple. And, you know, I can only think, well, I don't know what these physicalists are doing, you know, writing articles and books when it's so obvious that it's just the brain, you know, because there are correlations or something. So there's this category, you know, I call them internet materialists. I don't love the term. If you have a better one, I'm open to it. But the thing is, I used to be one of these people, you know, and I think maybe that's why I'm so harsh when it comes to internet materialists, because I used to be a completely overconfident dumbass when it came to materialism. And unfortunately, in my case, which is not the case for most people, there's an audio record of me being a dumbass about materialism. So I've been thinking about, you know, making a video or a podcast episode along the lines of debunking myself on materialism, and I'll take an older picture of me and put a dunce cap on myself and then, or something like that. It's just very frustrating to me when there are people who are not doing justice to physicalism, when there are people who are not doing a good job defending this idea that I don't even like and that I don't even think is plausible in the slightest. So I guess I just wanted to mention this category of internet materialists in my head, and that most people are internet materialists. You know, there are very few sophisticated defenders of physicalism. They do exist, and I respect them, and I think that they've written philosophically interesting books and articles and things that deserve our engagement. But the fact is, the vast majority of physicalists online are really not worth the time of day. And I think the fact that I used to be one of these people, I guess there, you know, there's a feeling of embarrassment. You know, it's like, I can't believe I used to act like this. So look, I have a lot to say about physicalism and non-physicalism, but as I said, I'm just sharing a few scattered thoughts. And yes, I have had a few drinks. Why do you ask? The reason I'm a non-physicalist comes down to something that's not that complicated. It's just sort of the hard problem of consciousness. Like, every physical fact you could know about some physical process doesn't entail that it's like something to be that physical process. So you can describe a physical brain process in as much fine-grained detail as you like. Brain states to individual neurons to atoms and quarks and back up to physical brain states again. No physical description, however complete, entails that it is like something to be that thing. You can always ask, you can always gesture at that physical activity that's being described in the mathematical gnomic terms that characterize physical science. You can always point to that physical activity and say, but why is it like something to be that physical activity? Why is it like something for that physical process? So asking that there be an entailment from lower level to higher level phenomena is not some new standard that I'm just pulling out of thin air. This is seemingly how every other reduction works. You can get a tree just by putting the parts of a tree together. You can, you know, it's plausible that you can explain organic chemistry in terms of non-organic chemistry. You can get a table from adding up the component parts of a table and putting them in the right relation to each other. And it's just entailed that you have a table. You put together the parts of a table, they have the right relation to one another, and you've got a table. There's no way around it. It just comes for free. You add up all the parts of a lizard, and it's just entailed that you have a lizard. You describe all the parts of a kidney, all the component parts, you put them in the right relation to each other, and it's just entailed that you have a kidney. You describe a physical brain state in physical terms, and it is not entailed that it's like something to be that brain state. This is seemingly how everything else works in the biological realm, which is where consciousness supposedly emerged, but for some reason, physicalists want the bar lowered just for them. So if subjective experience can be reductively explained, there should be an entailment from the lower level to the higher level. But we obviously have no such entailment, so reductive physicalism is false. It seems like you should be able to describe the microphysical phenomena, and it would just be entailed that you get the higher level phenomena like you do in all those other cases I just named. Okay, it's not like there's some special tableness that's over and above the four legs and the tabletop in the right relation to each other. Oh no, where's the tableness? You're missing what it's, you know, like it's not like that in the case of a table or a lizard or a tree or organic chemistry, but it is like that when it comes to subjective experience. So I don't feel like I'm raising the bar. I don't feel like I'm introducing some new standard. I'm not begging the question. I'm not special pleading. I'm just thinking that if consciousness is like everything else in the physical world, if it's like tables and chairs in biology, you know, organic chemistry, lizards and trees and kidneys and so forth, then it should be like, I don't think I'm asking too much to just say that like there should be an intelligible story to go from the microphysical phenomena to the higher level macrophysical phenomena. And yet, I can always point to this physical process and say, but why is it like something for that physical process? So not to put too fine a point on it, but once we describe all the cells in a blade of grass, the blade of grass just comes for free. That's a complete reduction of a higher level phenomenon to lower level phenomena. We have an intelligible story about how we get from one to the other. The blade of grass is simply entailed by the lower level. So we have a successful reduction. And the problem for reductive physicalism is that every physical fact you could know about some physical process does not entail that it is like something to be that physical process. So obviously there are, you know, responses and responses to the responses, and if you can believe it, responses even to those responses. But for me, it kind of is that simple. So look, there are convincing arguments against physicalism that I haven't mentioned, like vagueness arguments and the knowledge argument. And there are competing views that are, all things considered, you know, better explanations than physicalism that leave me with a lot less cognitive dissonance than physicalism would. But, you know, it really does come down to the hard problem. It just makes non-physicalism seem intuitive and even obvious. So I think the standard reply at this point would be, hey, you've been arguing against a priori physicalism. You know, you haven't been arguing against a posteriori physicalism, which is the majority opinion among physicalists these days. So an a priori physicalist will deny that there's even an epistemic gap between physical truths and phenomenal truths. So, you know, the thing I've been talking about has basically been some kind of gap between physical description, you know, like mass, spin, and charge, and phenomenal truths, like what it's like to see blue or taste pineapple or something like that. So an a priori physicalist will deny that there's even an epistemic gap. So zombies aren't even conceivable, color inversion is not even conceivable, and knowledge of physical truths entails knowledge of phenomenal truths. So an a posteriori physicalist will sound more sympathetic to what I'm saying, but they deny that the epistemic gap between physical and phenomenal truths represents any ontological gap. So they grant dualism, sort of, when it comes to concepts, but they say that mind and brain should be identified on the basis of empirical findings. But, you know, there's at least an epistemic gap. There's no conceptual entailment from physical truths to phenomenal truths. But, you know, when we poke your brain, your experience changes, so physicalism. I mean, I don't want to strawman them. They also... Yeah, I mean, it does pretty much come down to correlations, but they try to make more of a case like... They try to deny what I was saying earlier about lower-level phenomena just entailing higher-level phenomena. Like, oh, it's not so clear, you know, maybe this isn't even true with water and H2O, like, you know, there's some kind of distance between those two things, and, you know, that might lend support to the idea that physicalism is true, even though there's some apparent distance between phenomenal truths and physical truths. So there's something about that that's plausible at first, but I think it really depends on what they want to claim specifically, like in what dialectical context is this coming up in? Like, the devil is kind of in the details here. I will say that I don't think there's the kind of knockdown evidential case for physicalism that many physicalists, including a posteriori physicalists, seem to think there is. And I think that the way we even frame the issue, the way that you even pose the question, I think, is going to tend to lead you towards certain conclusions and away from other ones. So the way that I tend to think of this issue is not really in terms of identification, but in terms of emergence. So I think about evolutionary history and fetal development. Those are two things I come back to all the time when I'm thinking about consciousness coming about. So I think about the fact that our common sense picture of the world, whether you're a physicalist or a dualist or whatever, if you're any kind of non-panpsychist or non-idealist, then you think that at one point there wasn't consciousness, and then there was. It came about at some point in evolutionary history, on like a species-wide scale, or in just, you know, in the history of life, there wasn't consciousness, and then there was. And you think that this also happens on an individual scale. You know, there wasn't consciousness in the fetus, and then at some point, there is. So those are the two examples I come back to pretty frequently. And I think that that makes sense. You know, like if you're thinking that consciousness wasn't there and then it was, then you should think about evolutionary history explicitly. You should think about fetal development explicitly. You shouldn't just be thinking about water and H2O and a posteriori identification. You should be thinking about, you know, concretely, like, when did this come about? Where? Why did it come about the way that it did? Why didn't it come about 10 generations earlier or later? And what is it about the physical world that led to the emergence of consciousness? Why did it come about in evolutionary history at this point instead of some other point? And why did it emerge at the level it did, you know, at the level of organisms rather than herds of organisms or microorganisms? Why here and not there? You know, not only in time, but also, you know, at the level that it did. Like, organisms are definitely conscious, but why? Why wasn't it groups of organisms? You know, why wasn't it microorganisms that constitute organisms? You know, why isn't every organism like a society of subjects? So these are questions that don't go away if you say physicalism is true. One of the main things I wanted to talk about was the empirical project of trying to understand the mind. So the main point here, and I've been making this point forever, the data of neuroscience is underdetermined. The thing that we really observe, to put it as neutrally as possible, we observe correlations between physical activity and subjective activity. We don't really have fine-grained scientific instruments, you know, like every pixel of an fMRI represents millions of neurons. So our instruments are not as fine-grained as we might want them to be. But as best we can tell, with these very blunt instruments we have, there are tight correlations between the physical activity in the brain and the mental activity in consciousness. We don't know that there's like a perfect one-to-one correlation, but, you know, I mean, it's entailed by every form of monism that there would be a one-to-one correlation between the external, publicly observable aspect of the world and the internal, private aspect of the world, you know, whether you're an analytic idealist or a Russellian panpsychist or a neutral monist or a physicalist, you know, basically every non-dualistic view, you're committed to some kind of tight correlation. Because if you're trying to bring together mind and matter and say that they're really the same thing, even though they don't intuitively seem like the same thing, they're really the same thing, well, then there has to be this like very tight correlation, if not a perfect correlation. So a perfect correlation between human consciousness and the human brain and body is entailed by physicalism, by panpsychism, by neutral monism, by property dualism. It's only not entailed by substance dualism, and maybe on certain forms of property dualism, but putting that to one side, it's entailed by every form of monism and by even some forms of dualism, like property dualism or epiphenomenalism, that there would be a perfect correlation between human consciousness and human brain activity. So once again, the data are underdetermined. To put things neutrally, you know, we have correlations. Some people put things less neutrally, and obviously physicalists do this. Sometimes they don't know they're doing it, sometimes they do, but they present the correlations as if there's only one way to look at them, or as if they're more than mere correlations, like as if just the observation proves the identity, that like there's nothing over and above mass, spin, and charge, just organized in the right way, and like that's what consciousness is, you know. And we know that because our extremely blunt instruments have shown that there's a pretty tight correlation between brain activity and consciousness. Neuroscience is our most empirically grounded study of the mind. So naturally, many people place their bets on neuroscience to answer every conceivable question about consciousness. But there are some questions about consciousness that neuroscience just isn't equipped to answer, precisely because it's so empirically grounded. So to give a trivial example, neuroscience can't answer whether it's a good thing that consciousness exists or not. That's not an empirical question, though if you explore that question, you know, that'll probably involve appeals to some empirical facts. But just saying, you know, is it a good thing that consciousness exists? That's not something that the most empirically grounded study of the mind can reveal. So why is it like something to exist also does not appear to lend itself easily to empirical inquiry. I don't think it's the kind of narrowly defined question about the observable world that an empirically grounded discipline like neuroscience is equipped to handle, you know, even in principle. Why is it like something to exist? And yet, that's not a meaningless question or a badly formed question. There's probably an answer if you ask why is it like something to exist. So that brings me back to underdetermination. So I think the best way to make this point, this obvious point, without raising the ire of every internet materialist, is talking about underdetermination in philosophy of science. Like, most evidential data, you know, most of our observations are underdetermined. They're compatible with many theories. They're equally good evidence for multiple theories at once. And you have to decide between those theories on non-empirical grounds. You have to do philosophy. You have to wonder, hey, which of these theories is the most intrinsically probable? Which is the simplest? Which is the most theoretically virtuous? Which has the best fit with our background knowledge? Which is most compatible with other things we have a high credence in? You know, none of these things are sort of absolute rules. They are things that can alter your credence in one way of interpreting the data or another. So underdetermination, you know, it's a commonly recognized point. Nevertheless, many internet materialists do not understand it. So something like the correlations that we observe between mind and matter, you know, human consciousness and the human brain, that can be interpreted in multiple ways. You can interpret it as a physicalist. You can say, oh, you know what that means? That means that there's nothing over and above the physical brain states. So you can characterize consciousness in terms of brain states, which can be characterized in terms of nothing but mass, spin, and charge and other fundamental physical properties. So consciousness is just a matter of fundamental physical properties arranged in the right way. So that's one way of interpreting the fact that there are rough correlations between the human brain and human consciousness. But to the chagrin of some physicalists, there are other ways of interpreting it that are not ad hoc or kind of, you know, you don't have to twist yourself into logical pretzels to interpret them differently. So I think these things, I mean, I expect that these correlations will have a perfect, I think that the human brain and the human mind will be perfectly correlated because I'm a monist. So that's what I would expect given my view. Let's just say that we had perfect correlations, one-to-one correspondence between the human mind and the human brain. So would that prove that there are nothing but physical properties in the world? Like, no, that's a leap. Like, it's just, you know, physicalism makes specific ontological claims that are not justified by the correlations that we witness. And you might say, oh, is it the simplest way of interpreting the correlations? Well, I mean, even that's questionable. You know, I mean, Russellian monism is a pretty simple way of interpreting them. Dual aspect monism, I think, is synonymous with Russellian monism. So it's like, hey, there's this internal aspect, and then that internal aspect of subjectivity looks like something from the outside. So it's subjectively mental from inside and objectively physical from outside, but it's ontic monism and epistemic dualism. You've got one substance, or one process, if you like, and it's like something to be that process, and it's like something else to observe that process. So, I mean, just take Mary, the neuroscientist. It's like something to know all of the publicly observable data about seeing the color red. You can understand every pattern of neuronal firings. You can know everything there is to know about the neuroscience of seeing red and the physics of seeing red and every single bit of information that is publicly observable. But there's a difference between observing a process, a physical process, and being that physical process. So there's a distinction between being and observing. So the dual aspect monist, or the Russellian monist, sees Mary's gain of knowledge as something that does undermine physicalism. Physicalism states that there's nothing over and above the physical properties described by fundamental physics, for instance. You know, physical truths exhaust the truths of the natural world. So Mary knows all the physical truths. She knows all the publicly observable data. So to say that there's something that's not publicly observable does seem to be in conflict with physicalism. And you can find plenty of physicalists who will deny that there's any real distinction between publicly observable data and private subjective data. Sean Carroll just did it on Mind Chat, you know, and so did the other physicalist who was on there. And obviously Keith Frankish does. So this is not like a straw man, you know, like plenty of physicalists, you know, like they deny that there's any kind of private subjectivity. It's not available publicly, even in principle. And they give all these stupid analogies like, oh, well, you can't observe the dinosaurs and, oh, you can't see the center of the earth or something. It's so easy to pick apart. I don't really even believe them when they say stuff like that. Like, I can't help, and I try not to do this, but in this case, it seems warranted. How are they saying that in good faith? How is that not disingenuous? The non-physicalist is saying, hey, you have this private mental life that's not accessible in principle. And the physicalist in this case says, I can't see the center of the earth. So, you know, this is a fake distinction. That's what Sean Carroll said. And, you know, he's not the only one. So we could build instruments, scientific instruments that deal only in publicly observable information, and we could see the center of the earth. We could build the right scientific instruments that could enable us to observe the center of the earth. And it's not like the dinosaurs are unobservable in principle. We're just separated by time. You know, sometimes we're separated by space. Sometimes we're separated by time. Sometimes there's some kind of barrier between us, you know, in the case of the center of the earth. You know, if all technology, if all like travel was suspended somehow, like let's just say it was impossible to travel from the US to Australia, then it would be impossible for me to observe some of the creatures they have in Australia, but that doesn't mean that they're unobservable in principle. I lack the right instruments. I don't have the right instrumentation to observe the strange, the strange animals they have in Australia. It's wrong to say it's unobservable in principle just because I don't have the right instruments. So that seems to be the case with things that are separated in, you know, space, for instance. But when it comes to qualia, when it comes to private subjective experience, it doesn't seem like it's a matter of getting the right instruments. You know, like it doesn't seem like it's, oh, someday we'll have the right microscope and then I will be acquainted with your experiences in the same exact way that I'm acquainted with mine. You know, not like I'll read your brain activity and then it'll interpret that brain activity and put it up on a screen so I can see what you're thinking. No, like it's not going to interpret the brain activity. It's just going to put me in touch with what's going on in the same way that you're in touch with what's going on. You know, because that's entailed by what Sean Carroll is saying. If he's saying that the distinction between seeing the center of the earth and seeing your subjective experiences is identical, those are perfectly analogous. It's a fake distinction. Okay, well, we could create the right scientific instruments and we could see the center of the earth. We could observe the center of the earth. That means that you're committed to the view that we could create the right scientific instruments and we could be put in touch with your experiences in the same way that I'm in touch with mine, because it's all publicly observable, right? It's a fake distinction. So that's nonsense, and I don't even believe that he means that. Seriously, like I think that it's totally disingenuous. So it's obviously a real distinction. You know, we're never going to create a scientific instrument that acquaints you with my experiences. The best you can do is read and interpret my brain data and then, you know, maybe put it on a screen or something. And it's like, oh, this is what he's thinking. But it's not the same way that I'm in touch with those experiences. I can't even remember why I went on that tangent. It was something I heard in that interview and it annoyed me. But look, neuroscience is the most empirically grounded study of the mind. Naturally, many people place their bets on neuroscience to answer every conceivable question about consciousness. But the thing is, because it's the most empirically grounded, it's not equipped to answer every question. So I think, why is it like something to exist? You know, it just doesn't seem to lend itself to empirical inquiry. The data of neuroscience, it's, you know, like many other things, it's underdetermined. Like, you can interpret it as a physicalist, you can interpret it as a dual aspect monist. Oh, I think that's why I brought it up, because I was thinking, you know, it's like something to be a process in nature, and it's like something to observe that process in nature. And that's why Mary learns something new. And I think that might be actually a common point between me and some physicalists. Like, I think there's a distinction between being the process and observing the process, you know, and Sean Carroll said that, you know, not in exactly those words, but he did basically say there's a distinction between being the neuronal process and just observing the neuronal process. They don't give you the same information. Okay, well, that seems to be in tension, to put it politely, with his other view that it's a fake distinction between public and private, because it seems pretty natural to say, oh, you know, being the process is where you get this private information, and observing the process, obviously, that's public information. So look, this is the case in many issues in science. You know, things are under the right interpretation of quantum mechanics. You know, this issue is also underdetermined. What we actually know is compatible with multiple interpretations of quantum mechanics. And, you know, the same is true with the correlations. I think that's the way that we could put it most neutrally, is just talking about correlations. So the way that, this is the last thing I'll say, the way that physicalists argue, specifically internet materialists, reminds me of the way that biblical literalists argue. And I know that sounds like a very self-serving analogy, and it is. But for anyone who's familiar with both, I think that it's a clear analogy. It's the same denial of underdetermination. Many biblical literalists and Christian fundamentalists, they will say things like, oh, I don't interpret the Bible. It's wrong that there are all these interpretations of the Bible. I just read the Bible. It says what it says in black and white. If English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. You know, look, it's right there. I'm not interpreting anything. I'm just reading it. So there seems to be a similar sort of thing going on with internet materialists, where it's like, I don't interpret the correlations. I just see the brain states and phenomenal states as identical or whatever. You know, like, the brain states and phenomenal states are identical. I'm not interpreting them as identical. It just is clear that they are identical because they're happening at the same time. It's the same stubborn resistance to the idea that an honest person could look at the same exact data and interpret it differently without any ulterior motives or ad hoc pretzel twisting logic or motivated reasoning or bad faith of any kind. It's very hard for them to see it any other way. Any empirical data is going to involve some interpretation. And obviously, I hope I'm not giving the impression I'm talking about all materialists or all physicalists, you know. It's just there are some of them who seem to think that because there are correlations, that proves physicalism. and they don't really have any argument besides there are correlations, and they're so impressed by this fact that they pick one theory, which is supported by this evidence, amongst many theories that are equally well supported by this evidence, and they say, wow, if this doesn't prove physicalism, I don't know what does. And, you know, I've brought this up to a few of them, and they say, like, well, isn't physicalism the simplest theory? Yeah, you know, in some ways it is a very simple theory because it says there are only physical entities. You know, it's an attractive ontological claim to be this sort of monist, right? To say that, like, there's only the physical world, you know, like, it's ontologically very straightforward. But the question is, like, whether it can accommodate what we know about the world. And, you know, it doesn't seem like physicalism is up to the task. It doesn't seem like physical truths are up to the task of entailing phenomenal truths or of leading to any intelligible bridge between the two. So, yes, physicalism is simple in some sense. It's in some ways it seems simpler than other theories. But, you know, it's also a very simple theory that there's only one particle in the universe. That's very intrinsically probable compared to these competing theories that posit many, many particles, 2 particles, 3 particles, sometimes even more than 5 particles. But in my theory, there's only one particle in the entire universe, and it's very simple. Now, that seems like it's unable to accommodate the data of what we observe, and you would be right about that. So even though it's a simpler theory, it's still wrong because it's unable to accommodate what we observe. And similarly, physicalism seems unable to accommodate the reality of consciousness. So it seems like it's out to me. So look, your theory can be quite simple, but if it's unable to accommodate what we know to be true, then it's out. You know, it's I'm sorry, but it's like if it's unable to accommodate the reality of phenomenal consciousness, then I don't know what to tell you. You made it too simple. You know, it's like, you want it to be as simple as can be, but not simpler. Like I said at the outset, just I had a few scattered thoughts about physicalism that I wanted to talk about. Definitely check out the argument from Psychophysical Harmony with Dustin Crummett, which happened over on Counter Apologetics, because it's philosophy of religion. So even though it's related to consciousness, it ended up on the, Atheism and Religion podcast. So sorry about that. Usually consciousness stuff ends up over here, but it was more so an argument for God. So thank you for supporting the show. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.